The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to this special edition of The Guardian Football Weekly, where we'll be finding out about Sustain the Game, the campaign to protect football clubs. We'll discuss when and how supporters will be allowed back into stadiums and find out what Premier League fans in Saudi Arabia, North Korea and the UK have in common. Elsewhere, Celtic crash out of the Champions League, Chelsea splash more cash on Chilwell, and we'll get the very latest from Sidlow in Spain as Messi moves on. All that and a lot more besides in today's Football Weekly. And we also have a panel. Good morning to you, Barry Glendenny.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
Very well. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad, thank you.
Good. We're also joined by John Nicholson, Football 365 columnist, author of several books, including Can We Have Our Football Back? How the Premier League is Ruining Football and What We Can Do About It. Johnny, nice to have you with us.
Nice to be here, Melissa.
And also joining us is Kevin Miles, Chief Executive of the Football Supporters Association. How are you, Kev?
I'm very well, thanks, Melissa.
Great. We'll get cracking with this because we've got a lot to get through. First of all, Kevin, tell us what Sustain the Game is in a nutshell.
In a nutshell, the COVID-19 has put into sharp relief some of the problems that a lot of football clubs up and down the pyramid have had, in the sense that they have been deprived of income from their core activity. A lot of clubs, particularly League One, League Two and below, are entirely dependent on their matchday revenues, whether that's money through the gate or takings at the bar or whatever. And because they've been deprived of that through the COVID experience, then their real existence is in doubt. And that needs urgent intervention. But what we're talking about here is doing a little bit more than just putting a financial sticking plaster over those immediate crises and carrying on as before. We think there's been a new willingness to consider the long-term sustainability of the game. The things have to change in terms of how the game is managed, how it's regulated, how it's controlled, in order to make sure that, you know, football can prosper and, you know, at all levels of the game as we go forward. And that's what the Sustain the Game campaign here is all about, pulling together the principles are on that and trying to get some lasting change out of this opportunity of adversity.
And what do you believe are the main things that need to be fixed?
Well, there's obviously, there's an acute problem. There's a lot of clubs, particularly further down the pyramid, who for months now have had no income because they're entirely reliant on the money through the gate or the takings at the bar or whatever. Even at League One and Two level, where they haven't been able to complete the season, there's been a bit of a drying up of revenue streams there for them. And so there's going to probably need some injection of money, as there has been for across other industries, like in entertainment and the licensed trade or whatever else, some government support to get people over that hump. And in particular, some of those clubs face an uncertain future now because the public health situation is not exactly stable. But you know, for a club further down the pyramid, if you don't have matchday takings but you keep your players on, then you're losing money week by week, and that's not sustainable. So we need to make sure that's done. But what we don't want to do is to just put a bit of a financial sticking plaster over clubs that have got problems and got financial problems because they've been either badly run or just over-ambitiously and not sustainably run in the longer term. And we want to use the opportunity. There seems to be a new appetite at the Football League and elsewhere in the game to look at how we can make the game more sustainable, make sure that clubs don't live beyond their means, to make sure that they are not prey to unscrupulous owners who want to make a quick buck by asset stripping or whatever else, and just generally tighten up the regulation and the transparency of the governance of the game. And, you know, it's a bit of an opportunity here because, I mean, if you look at the salary caps proposal, for instance, in League One and League Two, which the EFL clubs have voted through last week, it may or may not be the perfect solution, it depends on your point of view. But the fact that they've taken the decision like that suggests that there's a realisation that something's got to change, and we're trying to get to grips with that and pull it all together.
You say there's a new appetite, Kevin. What backing have you had so far on this campaign? So you only launched it last week, didn't you?
We launched it last week with the backing of supporters groups at pretty much every club up and down the, certainly the 92 in the professional game, and then much further below that as well. We've had the support of some of the leagues at the lower level as well, further down the pyramid. And we've had the support of, getting off, I think it's 9 or 10 now, league clubs as well, who've put their weight behind it. Obviously, we, as an organisation, we have in membership some 30 or 40 supporter-owned clubs. Or community-owned clubs anyway. So they're obviously clearly all behind the principles. And so there's definitely growing support within football. We've got, you know, various different pundits and people that have been involved in the game have signed up for it. And we've had, since we launched last week, a second wave of people like that. But I think what's also significant is that we have the sign-up now of all three of the main political parties in England. The Conservative Party, the Labour Party and the Lib Dems have all said that they've endorsed the principles of our Sustain the Game campaign. And one of the focuses of that is the government manifesto pledge, which is for a fan-led review, their words, not mine, a fan-led review of the governance and regulation of football, which is due to be launched, well, sometime soon. And part of the objectives of the campaign is to try to map out what we think the terms of reference of that campaign should be. We want that to have quite a broad focus to make sure that we can start to get to grips with that. Now, there's been a number of times certainly in the time of my involvement in supporters organisations, which is a quarter of a century and more, where politicians have said to football and the football authorities, you need to get your act together here and tighten up the regulation of the game. Otherwise, we will intervene and do something about it. And every time that's happened so far, the football authorities have tended to make all the right noises. They've made appeasing noises about, yes, we're taking the point, we're going to get our act together and do something about this. And yet it's never really materialised. There's been some tinkering at the edges, but they've never gotten to grips with it. And there seems to be a bit of a change of mood now. Partly, I mean, I think COVID-19 has brought a lot of things into sharp relief. And there seems to be a bit of a change of mood among some of the politicians saying, you know what, you've had your last chances so many times. We are minded now to do something about this. And, you know, it's not a question of last chance saloon anymore. That bar's closed. It's past last orders. We're going to do it ourselves now.
John, can I ask you, in your position as officially football journalism's biggest snowflake and wishy-washy liberal and idealist, what do you think of this initiative?
I think it's obviously, you couldn't go against it. I think it's an excellent idea. My worry all the time is that the people who say they're going to do good things never do good things. I also think there are people who drag their heels on this, one of which is, sadly, the PFA, which has already opposed the wage cap and says it's illegal. To me, that just seems absolutely mad, because you've got your members are playing for football clubs that are not sustainable because of the wages they're being paid. You're trying to defend the wages they're being paid, even though that will put them out of a job. Now, that's just insane. That doesn't make any sense at all. So I think that it's a great grassroots movement, and all great movements do come from the people. But I think we have to be aware who the enemies are in this. If you don't ever identify your enemies, you don't know who you've got to fight. So that would be my major concern about it.
Kevin, if, say, the government did, and I know it's not your ultimate aim, but if the government did announce, like they have for showbiz and theatres and whatnot, a fund to help smaller clubs out in this time of crisis, what is to stop those clubs abusing that? Clubs, say, that are, would have been in financial trouble anyway through overspending.
Well, I mean, it's a really good point, Mary, and that's exactly why we put this in the context of the regulation of the game as a whole. Because, I mean, even on the sort of micro level, if I can put it at this level, there was a discussion about you don't want the government to give money where it's not needed. But you've also got to look at why it's needed. So in League One, for instance, just to take two clubs particularly, or absolutely at random, if you had fans of Portsmouth, say, who have been a fairly well-run club, who've been in the black for most of the time, certainly since they reconstituted themselves from that period of supporter ownership onwards, who've been a well-run club who haven't gone beyond their means, they probably wouldn't qualify for a government subsidy to ensure their survival because they don't need it. Somebody where a club that's not been quite so well run, who has a huge debt to service, or let's think of it, is there anybody you can think of in League One that would fall in that category? I don't know. Anyway, but you could argue, well, why would you give government money to an owner who's got themselves into that situation in the first place? You don't just want to subsidise bad owners. And that's why the question of the whole issue of it has to be tied to the issue of financial controls and regulation of the game as a whole. Now, we're not claiming to have the detail of all of the answers here, but we want to have a start to have a conversation about it. We quite like the idea that Damian Collins put forward, which was that rather than donating these money to football clubs, that the government intervenes and purchase an equity stake in those clubs. And the money is then repayable, but in the first instance, before, without any ability to contradict this by the owners, that equity could be offered to a supporters' organisation or to a local community to purchase back from government, or even have it donated to those organisations from government to get a community stake or a supporter stake in the ownership principle. Now, that's one idea that would, you know, maybe address some of those issues about not just throwing good money after bad into an unsustainably run club. But it's context is everything. The broader picture of how the game is run and how it's regulated. What this does is just puts into much sharper relief about where some of the contradictions, some of the howling gaps in the regulation of football are.
I think we also have to bear in mind that we need a complete culture shift in how we think about football and the whole sort of structure of it in terms of ownership. Because for too long, I mean, this isn't even a recent thing, you know, kind of rich local men have bought football clubs to self-aggrandise themselves. And we've relied on that as a model for probably literally since the start of football. And of course, in one way, it could be quite good if they're a benevolent dictator. But in another way, it makes you very vulnerable to the whims of some rich dude. And so basically, if he decides to call in his non-repayable loans or won't fund any more money, then the club's knackered. And I think we have to sort of get away from that model, really. And of course, the obvious way to go for that is to have the sort of 51% majority ownership. And I think that to take the edge off the nutters who buy football clubs. Because unfortunately, you know, it's particularly in this country, it's well proven that people who really shouldn't be running clubs are in fact running football clubs. So I think we need a whole cultural shift. And I think it also has to start at the Premier League, because particularly in the Championship, the toxic effect of the Premier League's money is corrupting the aims and ambitions of lower league clubs, and just as importantly, in fact, perhaps even more importantly, of their fans, who see these kind of riches in the distance and want the club to bet the farm on going up, and thus again putting the club at risk, and thus again making it vulnerable to be bought by people whose intentions are to be who are not, let's put it this way, their intentions are not the purest. And, you know, I think all of these things go together. There isn't just one lever to pull. I think there's just like lots and lots of different levers to pull and lots of things to be aware of running concurrently.
But, John, you're calling there for clubs not to be able to, and leagues not to be able to regulate themselves. But for that to happen, because they currently regulate themselves, they have to vote for it to happen. And it's kind of catch 22. It's not going to happen, is it?
No, it is difficult. Which is, of course, where the role of government should come in, really, I think. You know, well, at some point, there has to be some overarching power that says you can't keep voting to stab yourself in the face. And, you know, if that's not democracy. If it is, then it's stupid. It doesn't work. So, you know, we have to have a kind of more altruistic and an overarching view of the game to understand its implications for the rest of society, because I know, as Kevin has talked about much in the publicity for Sustain the Game, football clubs have a greater value to society than merely a business. They should be run as though they are a business in the sense that you can't spend more than you earn, but their import within society and within the civic structure of the UK is absolutely fundamental. And the game has never been treated with enough respect by governments. It's never been invested in at grassroots in the way it should have been. Its importance has never really been acknowledged. In fact, if anything, certainly going back to the 80s, football was seen as a problem, not as an asset to society, but as a problem. And indeed, it's still seen that way in many, many quarters. There is very little progressive thinking, there has been very little progressive thinking from any side in politics about football. And seeing what it can do to transform lives and societies at grassroots level. And in order for that to happen, you have to have a pathway from grassroots to local clubs, so you may end up playing for the first team at some point. You know, this all has to be healthy. If any of those bits start to become sclerotic and rot away, then all the good effects that football can have die with it. And I just think you need a holistic attitude, both administratively, politically, and culturally, to really appreciate that fact, you know?
Kevin, I think it's a year to the day I read somewhere that Bury went under and were expelled from the league. Has anything happened in that year, anything at all, to suggest that it won't happen again to another club? Because we were all very sad for Bury for a couple of weeks, and then we all kind of forgot about them, apart from their own fans, obviously, and life moved on, as we all knew it would. Has anything been put in place to ensure that won't happen again?
Well, I mean, the Bury thing is quite instructive, actually, because, I mean, even before they went under, it highlighted some of the problems that they had there, because, like you say, nobody wants to see a club go under. But even sections of the Bury support, their response to the crisis was to raise money from among themselves to give to the owner who'd got themselves in that mess in the first place, and the idea that that would help rescue the club. Now, there has been bits of progress on the margins of this, because the Football League has looked at the regulations, have looked at what's happened at Bury. They had a review of their financial governance. The terms of reference were narrowed after it was initially declared to the select committee. It was going to be a broad, you know, ranging look at the issues. The terms of reference of that particular inquiry were quietly narrowed. I think it's highlighted some of the issues that they've got to get to grips with, and there's awareness that they need to, but it's not been done. And it comes back to that point that you mentioned earlier. You can't leave the leagues to regulate themselves. I know there are people on the staff of the Football League, people that we work with on a regular basis, who are very aware of the problems that they've got here, who would love, as individuals and as an executive staff, to have more power to regulate and to tighten up the rules to make sure that the Bury situation didn't arise again. The problem they've got is that if they put the decision-making body in the Football League, as in any other league, is the member clubs. And if they put a proposal to tighten up their regulation, as they have done, the clubs will vote it down. And they vote it down, part even owners who would not have to worry about being not in compliance with those rules. One of the points that was made to me is at any one time, at least half of the clubs in the Football League are up for sale. The owners actually want to sell them, to get rid of them. They want to have a commitment to them. If, you know, they've invested in themselves, they actually really care about their clubs, but they'd rather not be owners anymore. But they can't get rid of their clubs. And one of the things that they don't want to do is to tighten up the regulation, not because they particularly are frightened of the regulation, but because it might frighten off a future potential owner who's going to take their club off their hands. So they've got a problem about it. And that's why we've come to the conclusion you cannot leave the leagues and the clubs to regulate themselves, because they won't vote for it. Now, ideally, a governing body should be doing that sort of regulation. And the FA should take that on and should have that role of regulating that. The problem we've got is that the FA has the same problem in that the decision-making and the power within the FA is dominated by precisely those big professional clubs. The Premier League and the bigger clubs in the Football League dominate the decision-making process in the FA as well. And that's why the same problem exists currently in the FA, that the financial vested interests will not vote for tighter regulation. And that's why, I mean, I share some of John's cynicism about politicians, but I'm rapidly coming to the conclusion that the football authorities are unlikely to do this themselves, because the clubs won't vote for it. And it's going to have to be externally imposed. And we can only deal with the politicians we've got. And at the moment, they are making the right sort of noises.
I was going to say, Kev, you've just really got to hold the feet to the fire on this, because, I mean, I've seen Oliver Durden in action, and he doesn't fill me with a lot of confidence. He doesn't seem to be intellectually quite across it all. However, as you say, we've got to deal with who we've got to deal with. But there is only one solution to this, as you're absolutely right, and that is essentially to have an overarching legal enforcement on how the FA and the Football League and everybody else concerned is governed. Because other than that, it's just going to spiral out of control again, isn't it? You know, there's not really going to be any profound change. So we have to have an overarching governmental attitude towards it, to regulate it the way we regulate any other industry. And without that, I don't think there will be profound change.
Kevin, we could talk for so long about this. We've only really scratched the surface. But I guess in terms of the bigger picture and further down the line, what's your kind of dream scenario 5 years down the line in terms of how clubs should be run and what should be adopted and where we'll be then?
Well, it's there's dreams and then there's 5 years down the line. I mean, I'd share John's vision of, I think the ideal model for football clubs is community ownerships, that they're represented by, you know, of their community. They're owned by the fan base and the local community and they're controlled by it. The 50% plus one model that's developed in Germany, I think it has a lot of admirers around the world. The big question around that, though, is obviously is how do you get from our starting point here to that particular model? And I think we need to remember, it's a salutary lesson, but in Germany, they started off from 100% supporter ownership. These were member clubs in Germany who have gone down to 50% plus one. Now, they've held the line at 50 plus one to make sure that they're never totally have become the playthings of magnates and industrialists and billionaires in the same way as they have here. But football clubs here have always been privately owned. So we're coming from a different starting point. The 5 years thing, I think there is a lot that could be done in that right direction. We've put together quite a lot of detailed work about the regulation of football. And I think our first focus is on this fan-led review. I take some comfort from the idea that the government has put in their manifesto that it should be a fan-led review. In other words, they seem to be wanting to take on the views of people for the law rather than just listening to leagues, clubs, football associations. In other words, they want that input. And I think in the Sustain the Game campaign, the five principles that we've outlined there about legislation to protect the local, protection to protect the assets of football clubs and to give them financial support, real transparency through the game so everybody knows who owns their clubs, what the rules they abide by, how the leagues operate their processes, that there's some financial controls that are independently enforced, not run by the leagues themselves, that the money is shared out across the pyramids to make sure that the whole of the game is sustained and that fans have a voice at every level. Those five principles, I think, provide a basis for what could be real progress if we managed to get some sort of regulator with teeth that was able to make sure that those principles were adhered to. Then, you know, football is still very wealthy and hugely popular. And that's a great starting point for anybody who wants to try to develop a solid base for a sport.
And Kevin, that is a great way to sum up part one. Coming up in part two, we'll be talking about getting fans back into grounds and why fans of Premier League clubs in England are going to miss out on being able to watch games. Welcome back to the Guardian Football Weekly. News from yesterday that Brighton are allowing 2,500 season ticket holders to attend their pre-season match against Chelsea at the Amex on Saturday as part of the government's pilot scheme. Other test events include Women's Super League matches, one between West Ham and Arsenal in September, the FA Vars and FA Trophy finals at Wembley on September the 20th. John, I'll come to you on this because you wrote a fantastic article earlier this month in which you said the change from the people's game to the game without people has been seamless. And from that, you obviously meant fans in the ground, at Premier League at least, are not missed, which is what you believe.
Well, yeah. I mean, essentially, the reason I wrote that was I was watching on the TV the Champions League final, and I thought, isn't it funny watching this, that almost absolutely everything is exactly the same, except there's nobody there. The players throughout seem to have played with the same degree of passion. They celebrate goals to an empty stadium with the same degree of gusto. TV and radio is all over it all the time. Papers are full of it. TV's full of it. Radio programmes, left, right and centre. The only thing that's missing is us. And I thought, well, it's funny, this is all going on. Does anybody really even need us anymore? Now, I know that lower down the pyramid, as we've discussed, clearly matchday revenue is the be-all and end-all. But at these sort of more rarefied levels, it seems to me as though, you know, if we didn't ever really come back, would anybody really be bothered as long as everybody paid up their subscriptions and watched it on the TV? I'm really not so sure they would. It seems as though we've very quickly got used to the idea of there being no fans. And indeed, I've heard people saying they actually like it more without fans, somehow perhaps fancying themselves to be students of the game and kind of more able to study it without the passion of humanity being involved. And I really felt as though, I mean, clearly clubs want to have fans back. Why? Well, you know, a little bit extra money to spend on your £100 Wagyu steaks is going to be very welcome, I'm sure. But I think a more profound question has to be asked by this, and it is this to this degree. If you've got a football club which really doesn't really generate hardly any percentage-wise of its money from a gate, then really the fans are not important to that club in the way that they once were. I mean, I always use the example, and Kev will know this, that, you know, Newcastle United earn 24 million quid a year, roughly, from fans coming into the ground, which is roughly just under half of a Joe Linton. And I use a Joe Linton as an actual currency now, because I judge everything by the Joe Lintons. So, you know, basically, Newcastle can just play to an empty stadium, and as long as they don't buy a Joe Linton, they're £16 million better off. Again, this is the extremely weird situation we've got with finances in football, where the very people who it is played for have become financially irrelevant to the game at the top level. And that is, if anything, illustrates how perverted the whole Champions League and Premier League structure has become, then it is that. It is that it's an entertainment business being played to entertain nobody within the ground. And now, if that isn't weird, I don't know what is.
But there was a lot of talk at the beginning of lockdown that broadcasters were going to want some money back because it's a devalued product with no fans in the ground, with that atmosphere taken away. And it will be the same when supporters, if they can go back in smaller numbers, with no away fans, it still changes the atmosphere. Do you think that argument's kind of gone away, though, as you say, as we've gotten used to fans not being there?
I absolutely do. The human being is nothing if not incredibly flexible and adaptable. And I think we've got used to it now. I really do. I hear people talking about football now in a slightly different way. And obviously, yes, the rights money is going down anyway and will go down further if they're, well, simply because they'll exercise the notion that it isn't as a stellar product. But then the right sellers will say, well, it is, because we've got all these players doing all of this, and all the TV audiences are largely similar to what they were before. And increase, obviously, when you put it onto free-to-air, it's a lot higher. So, you know, what's the reason for reducing rights fees, if this is the case? I am, as ever, with a lot of my work, I am being a touch flippant about it in order to question where we really are, to try and get to the truth. And I do think there is a shift going on. People want to go back and watch football. I absolutely see that. But I'm not so sure football is as keen as we are to see us back.
I mean, you said earlier that the time is right for a reset. And I wrote a column a few weeks ago saying that fans, while they're not allowed to go to games, have never been more important because, and I moved this theoretical possibility or theoretical scenario where fans are allowed back into grounds but elect not to go until certain conditions are met, you know, lower ticket prices, stop faffing around with kickoff times to, you know, disrupt away fans' travel plans, etc. Now, obviously, it won't happen, but it would be absolutely fantastic if it did.
What clubs need to do, I think, as a great publicity, a great PR gesture, would be when there are fans in whatever proportion let into the grounds, let them in free. Don't charge people. Let people come back and enjoy football free of charge. They don't really need the money at that level, at the top level. They don't need the money. Let stream it for free. You know, refund season ticket holders. Be generous. Stop being so obsessed with hoovering up every last pound. You would get great publicity out of that and great goodwill. And, you know, goodwill is in much need at the moment, I feel.
That's more than enough for part two. Sid will join us to talk Messi. We'll discuss actual football on the pitch and get stuck into championship matters, all in part three. Well, Welcome back to part three, where we can join Sid Lowe in Spain for the latest on Messi. Morning, Sid. A nice quiet week for you.
Yeah, it's been entertaining, to say the least, yeah.
A couple of days on from that bureau fax that rocked football, this morning reports that Messi's dad is in England talking to Man City. What can you tell us?
Well, what I can tell us is that City are looking into ways of making this happen. They believe they can find a way of making it happen, but they still know it's quite difficult. And of course, what could now happen, although I imagine that both clubs will be keen to avoid this, is that this could become a legal battle. And it could become a legal battle fundamentally about the interpretation of that clause. And for those who don't know, when Leo Messi renewed his contract with Barcelona in 2017, he had a clause inserted, which actually should have been a warning to them, the fact that he had this clause inserted even that long ago, that meant that at the end of each season, he could walk away unilaterally for free, so long as he advised the club before the end of the season. Obviously, he didn't do so in the first season, he didn't do so in the second season, and now he has said in this bureau fax that he sent to the club, I would like to leave and using the clause that's in the contract. The question mark now is when that clause puts the window of opportunity, if you like. At what point can you walk away? And that's where the argument is. And of course, if in the contract, the wording, and we haven't been party to the wording yet, if the wording is about a specific date, then that's it. That ends the argument. You know, if the date is, say, for argument's sake, I don't know, May the 31st or June the 10th or August the 20th or whatever it may be, that's it. If he hasn't told them before then he can't leave. If he has, then he can. And this, by the way, is why he used that mechanism of the bureau fax, which is essentially a recorded letter, because it's a way of proving legally, I told you. You can't claim you didn't know. So the argument now is going to be about the interpretation of that. Barcelona's interpretation, although they're being very careful about what they say publicly, is that ran out on June the 10th, because that is the end of the season. Of course, this is an unusual season. The season hadn't ended at that point. So the interpretation from Messi's camp is, well, the season hadn't ended. And I guess now the question will be, legally, what is the interpretation of that clause? If that goes to become a long legal battle, obviously it would make it difficult to leave now. So the question mark then is, which mechanisms do you use to make this happen, and can you force them through? And of course, the fact that you can force them through maybe forces the two sides into a negotiation anyway. And I suspect that that is how this will play out now.
So you do think he actually wants to leave? Because we spoke yesterday.
Yes.
Is this just a power struggle? Does he just want Bartomeu out? But you think he definitely wants to go?
It's well beyond that. I mean, obviously, there's no doubt that he does want Bartomeu out. And had Bartomeu gone earlier, we may not have reached this point. But it's well beyond a question of the presidency now. And, you know, to give you one of the very few public declarations of this, Victor Font, who is probably the most important of the opposition candidates at the moment for next summer's presidential elections, he was asked about this. And he said, look, I've spoken to Messi's camp. He said, the only chance we've got of him changing his mind is for Bartomeu to walk away, which, of course, a presidential opposition candidate would say. But in fairness to him, given how powerful it could have been for him, he also said, but Messi's camp tell me the decision is made. So it makes no difference now. So it's well beyond that. It's been coming for a very long time. That's not to say it's not a shock. It is a shock in the way that it's happened, in why it's happened and how we've got to this point. But, you know, the very fact that he wrote a clause into a contract in 2017 to give himself this option should he need it, and that he's reached that point, I suppose it's your Monopoly get out of jail free card. You know, he's had it sitting there for ages and now he thinks, actually, I do need this. The problem is that we're in a position now where the two sides are arguing over what that card actually says.
Sid, if this did end up in a bitter legal wrangle, it would make an already unedifying situation far more unseemly. And Barcelona can't really force him to stay. I mean, he can choose not to play. He can not bother, not try. I presume he will turn up at training out of his contractual obligations. But will they be able to reach some sort of compromise where Barcelona get money for him and he is allowed leave?
To be honest with you, that's how I see this playing out. Yeah, that's how I don't really see how you can force a player to stay, particularly a player like Lionel Messi, given all the emotional baggage that comes with that, the political baggage that comes with that. And of course, the fact that if he doesn't walk away now, he has 1 year left on his contract. So, okay, so he hangs around until the summer and then he walks away then. Now, admittedly, he doesn't want to lose a year. And that's one of the reasons why he's going, by the way, because he's so conscious of the fact that time is running out and he's absolutely desperate to win a Champions League before his career ends. And he's chasing the possibility of doing that. He just doesn't trust Barcelona, this board of directors, this club at the moment. So I think that's absolutely right, because, you know, if it becomes a legal fight, no one wants a legal fight. It's very, very few people actually want to end up in court. And that of course, becomes part of the, if you like, the pressure mechanism to force people to the table to negotiate. And I think you're right. I think the most likely scenario, and actually, while no one will admit it, I think deep down, probably Barcelona think, well, that's not a bad solution. You know, this is a player who earns around about 50 million euros a year after tax. In other words, costs the club around about 100 million euros a year. Now, for the sake of the argument, and I realize I'm making this oversimplistic, but let's round all the figures up more or less where they are. You save 100 million euros on his first season, 100 million euros on any kind of potential extension season, which obviously if he was to stay, it would involve an extension season. And maybe let's say, for argument's sake, you get 100 million euros off Man City for him, 300 million euros for a club. And it's worth stressing this, in a disastrous state financially, and just as importantly, a disastrous state financially, which will be the personal liability of this board of directors and this president when they leave the club after the presidential elections. That is why the desperation and the need and the desire to recover that money might turn out to be a decisive factor.
Which begs the question, what next for Barca? What next for Koeman without Messi?
Well, I mean, look, in a way, it's curious because I think these are kind of two different things. And so for argument's sake, let's play devil's advocate and let's say that Barcelona do get that money. It's very good for them financially. Let's say that out of the shadow of Messi, because they still have lots of very good players, they construct a really good team. Let's give them the ultimate benefit of doubt and say next year they are unbelievably good and they go and win the treble and they're the best team in Europe. And everyone laughs at Messi for having gone to Man City, who inevitably blow it against Barcelona in the Champions League final or something like that. Even then, I still think this would be a disaster for Barcelona in the way that it's happened. You know, in the way we're not talking about what happens next season, whether they can build a team afterwards. I mean, obviously they're looking at that and they have to, and it's their duty and it's what all clubs do. But this moment and the way this is ending will always be there now. You know, we're talking about the greatest player in their history, the greatest player possibly in anyone's history. And this is how it ends. I mean, you know, player leaves club is actually not that a big a deal. But player leaves club when it's Messi is quite big. Player leaves club when it's Messi, who's been at the club since he was 13 years old, who's made his home there, who's always said he wants to retire there, who leaves in this way. That's never going away. That's what was the dreadfully tortured metaphor I was thinking? Oh yeah, Lady Macbeth's stain. You know, that's just not going away. And yeah, it's terrible. But you're right. I mean, in terms of constructing the team, it's not impossible that they build a very good team off the back of this.
Reports though that Suarez, Rakitic are going as well. Have you heard any more on that?
Yeah, basically Ronald Koeman had a round of phone calls on Monday. And a lot of people have read into the fact that Suarez was told he was going on Monday as the reason why Messi then turned up with the bureau facts, because of course they're very, very good mates. Koeman did a round of phone calls on Monday and told Umtiti, Rakitic, Suarez, and the other one who escapes me now, who was the other one? Oh, and Arturo Vidal, that they weren't part of the plans. Now, of course, from Barcelona's point of view, there's lots of reasons to get rid of those players. One is politics, the power that they're seen to have in the dressing room, certainly in the case of Arturo Vidal and Suarez, who are close to Messi. The other is age. You know, with the exception of Umtiti, these are all players over 30. And in Umtiti's case, a brilliant player who just looks like an ex-footballer over the last couple of years because of terrible knee injuries. I feel really, really sorry for him because he was absolutely wonderful in his first season, but just hasn't been there since then. And, of course, they're all very high wage earners. Umtiti slightly less so. And you know, the background significance of the economics of Barcelona's situation, you know, you can't overlook that. And so that's the beginning of it. There are other players that we expected to be moved towards the door. Jordi Alba, Sergio Busquets, they've both been told that they're continuing at the moment. But I wouldn't be surprised if there are other moves over the next few days. The problem is, of course, that Messi, and this actually, I suppose, is part of the whole question with Messi and has been for the last 10 years. Messi eclipses all else in every way. And it is worth saying this, much as I think Messi is probably, without doubt, the best player I've ever seen play. That eclipsing of all others, that dominance of Messi, isn't without its problems. You know, it's not entirely perfect. And so you come back to your question about whether Barcelona will improve from this. They will believe that out of Messi's shadow, some of these players will be better than they were when they were playing with him. And I don't think that's a particularly outlandish thing to assume.
There's so much going on at Barcelona, but also you were at an actual football game last night, the semi-final between PSG and Lyon, the Women's Champions League semi-final. Really tight game, decided by a header from a set piece in the end.
Yeah, and a really good goal as well. Brilliant delivery, and Wendy Renard, who is about 1,800 metres taller than everyone else, she was so far above the rest. And it was the second header she'd had. There was one in the first half that almost dropped to her as well. Lyon are curious. I've not been, I say this as someone who's not claiming for a minute to be an expert, but who obviously been watching them through this tournament. Lyon haven't quite got going, but there's certainly something there. Cascarino yesterday on the right wing was brilliant. There were moments from them, but they kind of found their way through to the final. It feels almost like through know-how, through muscle memory, through just the kind of the repetition of the things that have got them there. Of course, this is their fifth final in a row now. They won the last four. I think it's 9 finals in 11 seasons for Lyon. I was really impressed with Wolfsburg against Glasgow City, but obviously the context of the huge gap between the two teams means, I don't know how seriously you can take a 9-1 in terms of judging how they'll play against others, not least because Wolfsburg, while they got through against Barcelona, probably should have been beaten. But yeah, it's Lyon and Wolfsburg in the final, and I suppose that's probably a predictable final. If at the start of the tournament, if you had to choose to be there, it probably would be those two.
Lyon, though, will be without Nikita Paris, a really needless second booking. She just sort of pressured the keeper and then clattered into her second booking, and she's now going to miss the final. That's a huge, huge blow for her personally.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think. This is what happens after a while. I lose the ability to speak English. There's a Spanish word for what Nikita was last night, which is revolucionada. You know, everything's kind of going too fast. You know, there was a moment early in the first half. You could actually see her and hear her asking the referee for protection because she felt she was getting booted around a bit. She got the first yellow card for complaining, not that first time when she asked about protection, but for complaining about a challenge 20-25 minutes later. And actually, she was entitled to complain because, she'd been fouled. It was a pretty clear challenge in what was a pretty tough game, actually. And then there was a period where she was sort of chasing everyone down with almost kind of with a vengeance, you know, a sort of a desire to really get there first. And she'd already got the card and you just wondered if it was treading a slightly fine line. That said, the challenge that she made that got her sent off, I think was unnecessary. I think it probably was a bit foolish, but it wasn't malicious by any means. She's chasing the goalie down and the goalkeeper kind of turns away from her. And she just sort of, I guess, like a cartoon character off a cliff. She just doesn't quite stop. And she carries on, goes through her. She gets sent off and misses a final. It's a real pity. It wasn't, as I say, it wasn't a great night for her. She wasn't really able to get into the game. She was kind of pushed about all over the place by a really tough back four. It's a real pity.
As you say, Lyon against Wolfsburg in the final. That's at the San Sebastian on Sunday. You mentioned Wolfsburg were good against Glasgow City. They just edged out their semi-final 1-0. Is there any way you can see them beating Lyon? Because as you say, 9 trophies in 11 seasons, 9 finals in 11 seasons. They're just so used to winning this competition.
Exactly. I mean, on the face of it, you look at that and you say, well, there's no way. But as I say, not being completely convinced by Lyon so far. And I wasn't that convinced by Wolfsburg against Barcelona. In fact, they were pretty fortunate to get through. Barcelona missed 4 or 5. I'd say 1 or 2 really good chances, 2 or 3 more pretty good chances. They had a very big penalty shout. Of course, there's no VAR in this competition, which I think is pretty questionable, if nothing else about the message it sends, you know, in terms of if you're taking the competition seriously, if this is your Champions League, if you are trying to promote the idea of equality, well, the conditions should be equal as well. You know, you're playing in 2 wonderful stadiums, albeit the pitch in Bilbao wasn't particularly great last night. It's very dry. But, you know, to not have VAR. Now, I personally, by the way, I prefer it without VAR. I'd much rather it wasn't VAR. But the point is, you know, in theory, at least your biggest competitions have VAR. Barcelona were a little bit unfortunate because of that. They claimed a second penalty late in the second half, which I must admit I don't see, although I'd like to see a replay. But there was one in the first half that they should have got. And Wolfsburg weren't that impressive and they were put under pressure. But there was something about them that they're that bit more athletic, that bit quicker, very, very good indeed on the break. And Harder, for example, has been brilliant. I don't think this is a foregone conclusion at all.
Sid, enjoy the final. Thank you ever so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Cheerio.
Sid Lowe there. Also last night, huge disappointment for Celtic, out of the Champions League after losing to Hungarian champions Ferencváros 2-1 at home. Barry, you were tweeting about this a lot last night. It's, well, nothing short of embarrassment for them, really.
It's an absolute disaster, but not an entirely unexpected one. Neil Lennon was furious after the game, saying that some of his players have had their heads turned. They want moves elsewhere. They weren't focused on the game. I mean, the game itself, they lost 2-1, came from behind, 1-0 down to level, and then lost to a late goal. They dominated the game. They had more than enough chances to win it, but they couldn't put them away, perhaps due to the fact that Odson Edouard, one of the players who wants to leave the club, wasn't playing. I think he was injured, although there may be more sinister circumstances, I'm not sure. But it's a disaster for Celtic. They now go into the third qualifying round of the Europa League, but to lose at home to Ferencváros, even at home with no fans, is embarrassing for them. I think Neil Lennon has to take some of the flack, but ultimately he can't put the ball in the net for his players.
Moving on to other news that happened yesterday. Chelsea confirmed the signing of Ben Chilwell from Leicester for $50 million on a 5-year deal. That takes the club's spending in this transfer window to around $130 million. They're really splashing the cash. I always think it's good to get a fan's view, i.e. a fan of a club who that player has just left. And I got a text from my mate, he's a Leicester fan, saying, no end product going forward, constantly out of position defensively, cheers for the $50 million Chelsea. Also, it's important that we give an update to another huge story yesterday, which is that Harry Maguire has been granted a full retrial in Greece after initially being found guilty of 3 charges. And in accordance with the Greek judicial process, the filing of an appeal extinguishes the initial court verdict and nullifies the conviction. The appeal has obviously been accepted and will lead to a full retrial in a more senior court. So Maguire has no criminal record and is once again presumed innocent until proven guilty. That also means he doesn't face any international travel bans. It's understood the retrial will take months, some reports suggesting it could be at least a year before it takes place. And that moves us on to other big news from yesterday, which was Soccer Saturday, axing pundits Matt Letizia, Charlie Nicholas and Phil Thompson. Barry, do you worry that there'll be a shake-up of the regular pundits on this podcast and that your position might be in doubt?
Well, there was quite a well-documented shake-up, involuntary shake-up a couple of years ago. And I survived
that one.
Well, survived is one way of putting it. Wasn't required to move. But, I mean, I like the guys. I enjoy the show, but it's the nature of television generally and the entertainment business to shake things up, change things around. What I found a bit tragic about this story yesterday was that as soon as it was announced, Micah Richards and Alex Scott started trending on Twitter because all these angry people on Twitter were presuming that Letiz and Charlie Nicholas and Tomo were being jettisoned so that Sky Sports could have a more diverse panel. And they were getting very angry at Micah Richards and Alex Scott, who haven't, to the best of my knowledge, been appointed as replacements or even approached, perhaps. I'm sure they'd both be very good if they were on the show. But, it is a show that probably could do with a little bit more diversity. But, you know, Ian Wright very eloquently said what I'm trying to say very ineloquently in a video he posted on Twitter, that the reaction to this has been little short of racist, and it's quite distasteful. But I wish the three lads well. They had a very cushy gig. They had a long run at it. I thought they were very good at it. I'd say Paul Merson must have been punching the air. He survived. But yeah, it's no surprise that there's been a shake-up, because those guys, there's a lot of viewers will never have seen any of them play. So maybe Sky just want to bring in people who younger viewers can identify with a bit more.
Talking of jobs for life, Neil Warnock at Middlesbrough, Johnny.
Hurrah! Good old Neil. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's like wheel tappers and shunters every day with Neil. It's fantastic. There's a reference for the kids. He's an absolute gift for the local press and for any media, really, because he just plays it all so well. He always gives everybody something to write about. But it was tremendous to hear him taking Middlesbrough down to play Plymouth and was going to give them all a barbecue in the back garden, which would include sausages and steaks. And he said, the nutritionists have said, I've got to give them chicken and rice. There's no way they're getting that. And I just love the idea that I suspect Neil thinks rice is fancy foreign muck. Yeah, Neil is looking for his ninth promotion out of the championship. So I think if eating steak and sausages at a barbecue in his back garden is a part of his ritual, then I think Borough must be on for a promotion this year. It's everything is all the stars are aligned, all the sausages and steaks are aligned. So we're going up. You heard it here first.
And we don't want to let you go, Kevin, without a word on your club, Newcastle, after a dramatic summer.
Well, during a previous discussion, John mentioned something about, you know, the pressure that sometimes comes from fans as well for clubs to overspend and, you know, be too ambitious, you know, going forward, and that, you know, destabilises the finances of the game in itself. Newcastle United have got a long way to managing that sort of thing. That's not really a danger here. The expectations of fans on Tyneside have been dampened down to such an extent that there's no such illusions on that. I'm sure the big signing so far of the summer, obviously, Jeff Hendrick coming in from Burnley, he will be worth every penny that's not been spent on him. And I think to say that the... people are underwhelmed by the prospect of the new state of the new season, where we have an owner who clearly does not want to be there. That's a matter of public record now, and not a realistic replacement in sight. And no, you know, a club drastically suffering underinvestment. It doesn't exactly fill your heart with joy at the prospect of the new season, does it? Let's aim for 17th.
Well, let's see. Kevin, you might be celebrating 17th place finish. John, Borough going up under Warnock. That's all we have time for today. Kevin, thanks ever so much for outlining the FSA's Sustain the Game initiative. We wish you all the best with it.
Yeah, thank you, Melissa.
John, thanks for being on the pod.
Cheers, man. Nice one.
Barry, lovely of you to join us again.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Melissa.
And on Monday, you can hear one of our favourite episodes of Forgotten Stories of Football. And then Faker Others will be back with you on Tuesday, along with Barry, Nicky Bandini and Barney Roney. But that's all for today's Guardian Football Weekly.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.